call the Civil Law Committee to order. Representative Lesh, you want to move the minutes from the last meeting?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesh moves the approval of the February 29th, 2012 meeting minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. A little bit of housekeeping. Representative Detmer's bill will be up first, and then just to the audience and committee, we've flip-flopped number two and three, so Representative Dietrich's bill will be after Representative Detmer's bill, and then we'll do the Stensrud bill third. So any questions? Representative Detmer, welcome to our committee. Representative Lesh, you want to move this bill?
I'd like to hold off on that.
Okay.
I got a couple questions.
The chair will move House File 1819. The chair moves House File 1819 to be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. So, Representative Detmer, I understand you have at least one or two amendments.
That's right, Mr. Chair. And
do you want?
I have the A3 amendment. You should have that.
Okay, let's move the A3 amendment to get it in the shape the author wishes. Representative Detmer, you want to tell us about the A3 amendment?
The A3 amendment is just to talking to council. This is just to get the language the way we want it, and also talking to the Minnesota National Guard. They had some changes that they wanted in the language, so that's what the A3 amendment is all about.
The chair will move the A3 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Any other amendments, Representative?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I got a couple of oral amendments. On line 1.12, delete who, comma, while participating, and insert after the word person, a comma, and then the words that in good faith participates. So after the word person, comma, that in good faith participates in any capacity, and it goes on there. So what you're taking out who, comma, while participating. And then on line 1.17, we don't need the word and in there, so take the word and out, put a comma, replace it with a comma. Then also line 1.20, take the word and out and replace it with a comma. And that should get the bill in the shape that we want.
Very good. Let me check and see that we've got that. Representative Detmer, I'm going to have Mr. Gehring from House Research restate that to the committee.
Okay.
I think it's
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Fairly straightforward, but
Mr. Chair, the proposed amendment is page 1, line 12, delete who, comma, while participating, and insert, comma, that in good faith participates, so that first part of that clause would read, a person that in good faith participates in any capacity in the program, etc. Line 1.17, delete and insert a comma, so the phrase would be willful, wanton, or reckless. And the same change on line 1.20, delete and insert a comma, so the phrase is willful, wanton, or reckless act.
Okay. Representative Detmer, what I understand, there was some discussions you had with some parties today on that, and that helps.
Mr. Carlson came into my office today, and we sat and chatted a little bit, and those were some language he would like to see changed. So, and I see it was a good way to improve the bill.
Very good. That's Joel Carlson.
Was it Joel Carlson?
Joel Carlson. Okay. Any discussion on the oral amendment? Does everybody understand what Representative Detmer's suggesting? Any discussion? All those in favor of the oral amendment signify by saying, the chair will move the oral amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Is that it for amendments, Representative Detmer?
That's it, Mr. Chair.
Very good. To your bill as amended in the shape that the author wants it, tell us what your bill does, and you may proceed.
I'm going to briefly just address the Yellow Ribbon Program and how this affects the Yellow Ribbon Program, but I also have a testifier here that will go into more depth of what we're trying to do here. But the bill provides immunity and civil liability for persons involved beyond the Yellow Ribbon Program. And as we know, that counties and cities and businesses can become Yellow Ribbon Program, part of the Yellow Ribbon Program. And we have right now over 3,000 National Guard men and women who are serving overseas. And many times the families need some support. And this is how the Yellow Ribbon came about, is to support the families. And with that, I would like to turn it over to Judy Seeberger, who's part of the Washington County Yellow Ribbon Program.
Ms. Seeberger, if you'd introduce yourself for the record and proceed. Thanks.
Thank you. My name is Judy Seeberger. I'm the Vice President of the Washington County, the Yellow Ribbon Alliance of Washington County. What the Yellow Ribbon Networks are basically community networks of support for deployed military personnel, their families, and veterans. It's not limited to support for National Guard. It encompasses every service branch in the United States. What it is the state of Minnesota got together and said, we don't have an active military base in our state. We have a lot of people that are affected by the mobilizations and deployments, and we don't have a good way to support them. The National Guard was put in charge of developing a program to spread the word to communities, and that's kind of how the ball got rolling. Washington County is recognized as a Yellow Ribbon County. I'm also the chair of a consortium of cities, including Bayport, Oak Park Heights, West Lakeland Township, and Baytown Township, also recognized as Yellow Ribbon Counties. And basically what we do is when we identify a need or a need is sent to us, we send the word out to our communities and the core people within our communities and get the person the help that they need. I'm also the wife of a Navy reservist. My husband was mobilized and just returned home a few weeks ago after being gone for a year. I have two little boys, and I was able to tap into the network also, and the support, really the community support, is amazing. The intent behind this bill is, let's say that I need help cutting down some trees in my yard, and I put the word out through the network, and some volunteers come to help me out, and while they are cutting down trees, somebody gets hurt. The idea was that we want to shield the actual networks from liability, which would be the network that put out the call, maybe my local network or the community network. So that the idea is to grant immunity to those networks for any kind of liability. And we approached Representative Detmer with that idea, and now we're here today.
Okay. Any questions for Ms. Seeberger or Representative Detmer?
Yes.
Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Detmer, in the instance in which your testifier talked about, what would happen if the person giving the service was a professional tree service and they dropped a tree on the house?
Yeah. Representative Detmer?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative, it covers those volunteers, and in a tree service, they are bonded, they're insured, and so that would, I think that would be covered there.
Representative Holbert.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Detmer, I don't see where it says a volunteer. It says a person. I mean, quite frequently, we have a tree service. Mm-hmm. We've done tree work for people. I don't know that if they were technically in the Yellow Ribbon program. I think that's fairly new in Dakota County. But for years, we've helped people out in a variety of circumstances. We don't get paid. I'm assuming that means we're volunteer. But, I mean, and I look at, like, this talks about, like, counseling. I mean, if you were a professional counselor and you volunteered your hours and you did something that was really bad or made a really bad recommendation, I mean, I get where you're going with this, and I'm with you 110%. If it truly is a volunteer trying to take a tree down and they drop it on the house and don't have any insurance or whatever, I get that?
Mr. Chair, I think if you look at subsection 3, exception, this section does not apply to a person who provides services to an active or reserve service member or to an immediate family member of the services member during the course of a person's regular employment or for which the person receives compensation. I think that would be covered. That would cover that situation. Am I correct?
Does that address your concern, Representative Holbert?
Mr. Chair, I don't know. I mean, I'm guessing frequently they don't get paid.
Representative Holbert and Representative Detmer, maybe Mr. Gehring wants to weigh in on this, but as we look at the language of the A3 amendment on 1.6 through 1.8, it seems to kind of reinforce that language with voluntary assistance. But Mr. Gehring, do you have any comments around this question?
Mr. Chair, I was going to point that out. In the A3 amendment, services is defined as voluntary assistance on 1.6 to 1.8 of the amendment.
Other questions? Representative Blesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to hold my question until we heard from any opposition. Is there any opposition testimony scheduled?
That's a good question, Representative Blesch. Is there anybody in the room that would like to testify in favor of or against this bill at this point? Anybody else?
Okay,
there is one Representative Blesch for sure. Representative Blesch, should we wait until, let's wait until that person testifies? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah, because it might resolve some of my questions, Mr. Chair.
Will do. Thank you, Representative Blesch. Please come forward, sir. Sir, if you would introduce yourself for the record and proceed, we appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. My name is Dan Whitman. I'm from Martin County, Minnesota. I happen to be here with a contingency today from Martin County, and I didn't come intending to testify, but I saw this on the agenda, and so wanted to offer that I am a member of the Martin County Yellow Ribbon Committee, one of the founding members. We were recognized over a year ago, and we have run into some issues with liability, and so just wanted to testify in favor of the bill. Because I believe it would help us with some of our issues. If you have time for two brief instances, I'd be happy to share that with you.
We do, Mr. Whitman. Please proceed.
We had an instance where we've been a very active committee providing a number of different services to our deployed National Guard troops. And as we've had a great response from our community, we've had the opportunity to share some services, and one wonderful individual donated a car to us that we thought would be great because we knew we had a couple families who, you know, didn't have transportation for their children and themselves. We learned that because of potential liabilities and stuff, there's just no way we could loan that car out and help them out other than to just donate it to them. And so still got the car right now, but because of liability issues, we were just really restricted. The other instance that really stuck out to me is we had a big party for our families to try and help them to feel family support and community support. We had people willing to donate hay rides for that event, but then we were told that we wouldn't be able to do that because of the potential liabilities that would come from, you know, providing these young kids with an opportunity to go on a hay ride. We were very fortunate that we were able to partner with another organization, the 4-H clubs, who covered us insurance-wise so we could do that one event. But those are the sort of things that we're running into, potential liabilities with people providing a service and worrying about getting sued or a potential liability that's not going to allow them to blow snow or provide an enjoyable afternoon outing. So I just wanted to speak in favor of the bill and say that we could use some help with it.
Thank you, Mr. Whitman. Anybody else that would like to testify in favor or against the bill? Thank you, Mr. Whitman. It looks like there aren't any. Representative Lesch, would you like to proceed with your line of questioning?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So I know the bill is intended to help the program, the organization. My question is more related to the soldiers themselves and the families themselves. And I wonder if when I'm deployed and my wife, say, needs tree trimming maybe or something, and And she calls the Yellow Ribbon, and from my experience, some of the soldiers that I know, their spouses are pretty young and don't know who to turn to, really, with anything from a furnace or a boiler or tree trimming or anything. So they can turn to Beyond the Yellow Ribbon, which is good. But if they rely wholesale on that, and Beyond the Yellow Ribbon then says, well, we got this guy who can do it for free, and we really don't know much about him. We're not going to check into his background and credentials, but he says he'll do it for free, so that's good. So Beyond the Yellow Ribbon says to my wife, yeah, this guy will do it. Take care of it. Well, then the guy drops a limb on my house, like Representative Holbrook suggested, and my wife doesn't know what to do, but she pays to have it fixed. Well, when I get home, does this bill then remove Beyond the Yellow Ribbon from the list of people that I could look to for recourse for that tree? Could I still then have a claim against them, or would I be limited? Say the volunteer is judgment proof. What happens to me?
Representative Detmer or Ms. Seeberger, any comments to that?
I can address that. In terms of the networks themselves, I will point out most of us are judgment proof as well. We're simply volunteers with our time that send out the word to get this done. My response to your question would be yes. It would be unfortunate if the guy himself was judgment proof and didn't carry adequate insurance or the means to compensate, but there really is no, the idea that there would be any additional resources in the networks themselves, there really isn't.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Lesh.
Then my question is, with the passage of this bill, would there be any remaining incentive for Beyond the Yellow Ribbon to do adequate background checks into finding out that the people you refer, are qualified?
Ms. Seeberger?
Representative Detmer was asking me if the networks do background checks and that kind of thing, and it kind of depends on the network, but sort of a driving force behind all of us when I've been involved in a few community kickoffs, and that concern is always raised by members of the community in that we don't, as a network, want to set anybody up with a bad apple. We don't want to send out the person that we don't know anything about that they'll just do for free. And the idea is that since we're a grassroots organization, when the referral comes in, somebody is referring them based on that they know the guy, that there is some reputation there. And we would never just blindly, or the networks I've been involved in would never blindly point to an organization and say, try this guy. So there, in that regard, and that has been a concern of every network that I've been involved with, we're not going to set somebody up with an unknown. It's just not what we would do.
Okay. Representative Lesh.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I understand that. And I understand with the stories about, no hay rides and kind of thing seems kind of like a bum deal. I understand that. I just wonder why we would remove that recourse. I'm thinking about the soldiers that come back. If something were to happen, and I can imagine what would be said to me by a soldier when they find out they're left holding the bag, they're going to be really, really upset. And they say, why would you pass a law like this protecting an organization instead of protecting the soldiers? And I could say, well, I was hoping that the organization would do good stuff for the soldiers. And like, well, they didn't for me, so that's my concern.
Ms. Seeberger, does the soldier and his or her family have to accept the services that the Beyond the Yellow Ribbon program offers?
Not at all. It's the services are offered to anybody who asks. If they don't have to take them. They're free to do whatever they like, basically, and even if a service is offered, they're free to reject that person and not follow through with it. One other thing I was thinking is that in terms of the fact that this is voiced in terms of voluntary assistance and it doesn't apply to companies and that kind of thing, it would seem to me that in your example, if the guy that comes and does the tree trimming is judgment proof himself personally, perhaps he has homeowner's insurance or something else that could apply also. And since it's a volunteer effort and not done for business, the business exclusion in most homeowners insurance wouldn't apply. And there probably are resources available that wouldn't leave the service member and his family out in the lurch.
Representative Lesch, any follow-up?
No, Mr. Chair.
One question I have, Ms. Seeberger, and it kind of ties into, and Representative Detmer, it kind of ties into Representative Lesch's questioning, is what is, I'm looking at the language on 1.14, and what is the beginning and the end of the program, and when this this exception would, this protection would exist? Is there a, I would expect you're saying that that would be defined by when you begin to work with the family and when you end the work with the family. Representative Detmer?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and yeah, I guess you could say that I would agree with that. It's when they start and when they end the volunteer service. And I do have another verbal oral amendment on 113 that was just pointed out to me.
Cool.
After the word program, just eliminate the comma, just put the word and in there.
Okay.
Line 13, after the word program, take the comma, eliminate the comma, and then put the word and.
Okay. Mr. Gehring, would you like to restate the amendment for the committee?
Mr. Chair, the proposed amendment is page 1, line 13. Delete the comma, insert and.
Representative Scott, are you willing to move that?
Sure, I would move that.
Representative Scott moves the oral amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor proceed by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes and the oral amendment is adopted. Representative Detmer.
And I'd like to have Mr. Carlson come up and address, I think, Representative Lesch's concern that we might have that when if this bill goes forward, we can make these changes.
Mr. Carlson, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Joel Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice. I had the opportunity to meet with Representative Detmer about this bill and just had a couple questions that the committee has obviously picked up on, and appreciate his the representative's willingness to kind of address these. Everyone supports the concept of this bill. I don't know if I want to attach an anchor to it and giving it my endorsement. I know my batting average in the committee here, but there are a couple things, and what we talked about, and what Representative Holberg is onto, and Representative Lesch, is that you can be a business and provide a volunteer. I use the example of an attorney providing advice to a deployed a service member's family. I could give negligent advice and be protected by this bill, and I don't think that's what anyone intended. We had a similar situation, and we have a similar law like this as it relates to volunteer physicians, coaches, athletic trainers, and the exception there, which I think Representative Detmer would like to pursue, is that if the acts or omissions are covered by your insurance, this does not apply. And so in the situation of a professional giving negligent advice, their insurance is going to cover that, and you don't want to provide this protection to an injured party when there is insurance available to pay for the damage that has been caused. And so I think that that's what I think he would like to look at, is having language like we have in 604A, 604A.13, as it relates to volunteer coaches, that just says to the extent that acts or omissions are covered by an insurance policy issued to the person, this wouldn't apply. And that gets at the boiler repairman that does it incorrectly. Even though he's volunteering, he's covered for those losses, and that's what I think you're trying to get at. And the question as to whether or not there would be any entity available for a recovery, I think you need to, you know, just remember that this is focused on getting the individual to volunteer. It doesn't protect the National Guard. It doesn't protect anyone else. It protects the individual or the business that is providing the service and no one else. So you would maybe have other recoveries that you could make. But the individual who, by the way, good faith is the standard, and I appreciate you adding those words, an individual who in good faith volunteers without compensation would be protected, and we want to encourage those people to provide those services, and that's why we don't have objections to the bill, although we think we can improve it a little bit with some changes.
Further questions on the bill? Seeing none, Representative Mahoney.
I take it we're about to vote on the bill. Is that correct?
Yes.
Could you reiterate where this bill is going?
Representative Mahoney, it is going to the General Register.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Mahoney.
And Representative Detmer, would it be smarter to send this back to Commerce to deal with the insurance issues? Because the question is, you're holding up an amendment, you have one that...
We're not, Mr. Chair.
I'll refrain from questioning and let the author speak.
Representative Detmer.
Mr. Chair, I do have another verbal amendment, and it's in writing, so I can give it to Mr. Chair, and that would eliminate the problem that we have here with the insurance issue. But on page 1, line 22, after apply, insert.
Semicolon.
Okay, the semicolon and then the one. This is hot off the press, by the way. And then page 2, line 2, insert the period. Insert the semicolon, excuse me, or 2, to the extent the acts or omissions are covered by an insurance policy issued to the person or the entity for whom the person serves. And I can give this to you to read.
Representative Detmer will get a copy to Mr. Gearing. Oh, he's got one, Representative Detmer. Mr. Gearing, could you read those changes back for us?
Mr. Chair, the proposed amendment, which I think you're getting copies of to pass out to the committee members, is page 1, line 22, after apply, insert a comma, and then a 1 in parentheses. And on page 2, line 2, before the period, insert semicolon or in parentheses 2, to the extent the acts or omissions are covered by an insurance policy issued to the person or the entity for whom the person serves.
Representative Holbert.
And Mr. Chair, I mean, I think that's an improvement, but I'm still really afraid of the unintended consequence of this. Let's go back to the tree guy. Maybe I should have insurance, but I don't. And just because, you know, I mean, I want to accomplish what you guys want to accomplish. I really do. But words have meaning, and this isn't as simple. And if we do something here where if it's a situation that just because this interaction occurred through a program, that there's going to be less protection for the military family as a result of some bad actor, we haven't done a service to the military family here. So... I don't know if we want to send this to the floor or whatever, but I think this amendment takes care of one part of it, but I don't think that it provides the level of protection that if we have somebody that's, you know, and things happen, and that should have liability insurance, but has let it lapse, or, you know, used to be a professional tree person for 15 years, and now they retired, but they really should have known better. I'm certainly supportive of the amendment, but I think there's more work to do.
Representative Mahoney's got a question, but Representative Mahoney, I think we'll... I'd like to move the amendment first. Members, and the amendment is actually drafted and in front of us. It's the 812-0711 amendment. And so I would move that amendment at this time. Any discussion on the amendment as presented in front of you? Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, like you, I'm going to get a copy and look at it. But if you don't have insurance by default, I think you'd fall into the immune from liability category if you're involved with this program, because there's no policy that would cover anything. So I'm not sure if is your concern that you want these people, if they happen to not have insurance policy, to still be liable, or the way I heard your concern was if somebody was maybe supposed to as a tree trimmer, but for whatever reason their policy lapsed, or maybe times were tough and they didn't have one, is your concern that then they would somehow be thrust into liability? I think the opposite would be the case, because there wouldn't be a policy to cover it. But can you clarify?
Representative Holberg.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Westrom, I'm worried about the inadvertent consequences for the military family. I mean, if they have somebody that they know or is reported to be a professional of whatever type, and so there's some risk to the type of work that this volunteer is now doing, that ordinarily a regular consumer would have some protections, they're going to be like, they won't even have the rights of recourse of an average consumer, because of the fact that this transaction occurs through a volunteer yellow ribbon program or whatever. And I think we're putting our military families potentially in a worse situation than the average consumer as a result.
Representative Westrom?
I would, and Representative Detmer, maybe you can add on to this. It seems to me that were the person not volunteering through the yellow ribbon program, the family wouldn't have access to that service, whether they have insurance or not. The reason that they're probably volunteering is the family probably can't afford the service otherwise, and so I think the spirit of this is to promote good faith volunteering and telling people, it's like the Good Samaritan law. If you're helping out a very noble cause here, we're not gonna hold you to some high standard in certain cases, that if the person in the accident gets hurt or dies because you tried to help them in good faith, we're gonna all of a sudden come after you. We're doing the opposite. So I'm thinking it's a great improvement from where we would be today for the family or the military, either way. But maybe I'm seeing it differently.
Representative Mahoney, was your question kind of to the amendment? I know Representative Lesh is up.
Not at the first, but now it is getting there.
Go ahead, Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, Holberg, and committee, I'm of the same nature. I think that I know I want to help service people that are stationed anywhere around the world. I volunteer a lot of time on many different issues. But you would not want me to volunteer to do electrical work in someone's home, which under this program I easily could and be asked to, because I am not a good electrician. I'm really not. And I could probably burn your house down. So what happens, though, is that I have no insurance to cover that. Yellow Ribbon Program has no insurance to cover that. And if the homeowner has no insurance, homeowner's insurance to cover something like that, the service person is stuck holding the bag. This is an insurance issue and a liability issue. So the liability needs to be dealt with in this committee, but I think the insurance part of it needs to be dealt with over in the Commerce Division. So I'll leave it up to the Commerce Chair to see if he wants this bill back in his committee. And Professor Pender gets to weigh in, but I don't think we've come anywhere near figuring out the liability on this particular one. So it's not really a question, it's a kind of a statement.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if, I don't know if Mr. Gary can answer this or not, or maybe someone else around the table can, but I'm wondering, Representative Holberg's questions called to mind a question I had. Well, what if the family does have insurance, homeowners insurance, which if you're a young family in a new home, you have to. You're going to have it anyway. Home's not paid off. The mortgage, the bank would require it. So to the extent that that homeowner's policy subrogates the right to sue, the family subrogates the right to sue to the insurance company, if you have insurance, and that insurance company now has another avenue of recourse removed from them to sue, does that soldier's family now have the chance to have their homeowners' rates increased simply because they have a deployed soldier and they're benefiting from the Beyond the Yellow Ribbon program? Mr. Gehrig, if you could answer this, is there anything in state law that prohibits an insurance company from raising rates on the family of a deployed soldier?
Mr. Gehrig?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, I don't know the answer to that question. I'd have to look into it.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, I...
Representative Lesh.
I don't know. I guess I'd like to know the answer, because it is one of those things where now, just because of my status as a soldier, an insurance company could say, well, you're costing us more money because if something happens, yeah, you know, we're going to be paying out. And we can't sue. We can raise your rates. That would make me really nervous if they could do that. And if the answer to that was yes, then no, insurance companies couldn't raise your rates simply because of your status as a deployed soldier, then that would alleviate my concerns.
Representative Poppy. Representative Detmer. Excuse me, Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and members, Representative Lesh, I think your question is answered in Chapter 192 as it relates to obligations of employers and others as it relates to deployed military personnel, and I don't think that they can discriminate you against you in any way based upon your active military status, but I'll confirm that, but I think it's in Chapter 192. And as to the electrical issue, which would be a problem, but I can tell you that that is not a person who is volunteering in good faith. A person who volunteers in good faith does it at a proper time, with a proper motive, on a proper occasion. I would say that a person who volunteers to do electrical work, who is not a licensed electrician, is reckless and is not a good faith volunteer. And now, that is just, that doesn't help the problem, because your problem is, what do you do when there is a volunteer where they have an accident or something happens? I understand the problem that you're trying to get at, but it isn't that one as far as being protected by this bill. But, you know, there, that is a problem. And, you know, we have a number of volunteer protections in Chapter 604A. And we do have some faith in people that they are going to volunteer at the appropriate time, whether it's putting on an automatic external defibrillator or donating their time to a military family. We have a number of areas where the legislature is said to encourage this activity. We want to make clear what the liability is. You guys are just appropriately making sure it doesn't have unintended consequences. And I know Representative Detmer, from talking with him this morning, wants to make sure that that doesn't happen. And I think that's why he's looking at these amendments, to make sure it's as tight as possibly can be. And we're happy to work with him as he moves the bill forward.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Let's hear from the Commerce Chair, Representative Hoppe.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe Mr. Carlson or someone else can answer this. I think we're all supportive of the bill, and I think we want to, I mean, it's here to make sure that people that are doing the right thing for our soldiers and our community aren't being prosecuted for something inadvertent. However, if we go back to the tree trimming example, I mean, I hope we're not doing something here that's going to fall back on Representative Lesh or another soldier or their family, because if we have a tree trimmer who's got immunity and can't, I mean, if they drop the limb on the house, who does pay for that? And I want to make sure that we're not, I mean, I think we're all supportive of this and we all want to see it go on, but, you know, is it the homeowner's insurance? What if they don't have insurance? I mean, then who is going to pay? And we're talking about a what if, but I think if we're passing this legislation to try to protect people from immunity, we should be, that's one of the questions we should get answered.
Other questions? Representative Hoppe, have you any inclination whether you'd like to see this bill if this amendment goes on or not?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I would rather not. I hope we can get this question solved here, but if it, you know, if we can't figure out how the insurance would work in this, I mean, I would talk to the author about this, but maybe we want to have it go there, or maybe we very temporarily lay it over so we can figure that question out. And maybe Mr. Carlson can shed some light on that. I mean, what happens if we have volunteers helping somebody's house, or Representative Westrum might have an answer there. But, I mean, if it's not the person that drops the limb and it's not the Yellow Ribbon organization, if there is a limb or something else happens, you know, if Representative Mahoney is there doing the electrical work and there's a problem, who does wind up being liable for that?
I think Mr. Carlson or somebody had mentioned that, or maybe it was Representative Mahoney or Lesh, mentioned that, you know, if you've got a young homeowner, they're gonna be required to have homeowners insurance in order to have the mortgage on their home, unless they're independently wealthy enough to be able to not have it. In that case, they would probably just hire the service rather than require a volunteer in. So I think we're on pretty good ground here. Representative Westrum.
Mr. Chair, you know, it's kind of like drafting a will. You could put 10 successive personal representatives in place because the son and the daughter and then the other son and the other daughter could all die before mom or dad, and their son and daughter could be in the same plane crash, and then you need to have the cousin who also could be dead because of something else, and then, you know, you could burn through all kinds of scenarios. So there's probably some scenario where we aren't going to get it covered. But I'm wondering, Ms. Seeberger, how do you handle that now if a tree limb would fall on a house like Representative Hoppe asked? And I'm thinking the simple answer is the volunteers would probably rally around and come and fix the error that, or the mistake that happened, because there's invariably going to be something that doesn't go right every time. But do you carry insurance? Do you have situations where somebody would come back and sue you for something that's been damaged to their property?
Ms. Seaver.
Thank you. Right now, the only recognized formal entity from Washington County standpoint is the Yellow Ribbon Network of Washington County, and we do not carry insurance at this time for that purpose, which was part of the rationale for approaching Representative Detmer for this bill. I think you've hit the nail on the head. If something did go horribly wrong, number one, as a part of the network, I think everybody would be absolutely horrified and willing to do whatever they could to right the problem. If a tree limb did fall on a house and cause damage, I'd bet you that, you know, there would be a line of people out the door willing to come in and fix that house. I can't imagine another scenario where the network would turn their back on a person who needed help, and that help either made the situation worse or caused some other problem. I just can't imagine a scenario where that would happen, where they wouldn't get the additional help they would need to make it right.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just thinking of the numerous programs across the state under the Community Action Program Network and all of the hundreds and thousands probably of volunteer services they perform. I wonder if there's something in law that's parallel, because certainly there must be some similar immunity that they have working for them.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, there is. although it's not an immunity. They are covered by Chapter 466 municipal liability, so they have liability, although it is limited. So it's not an immunity situation like you have here. They have liability under Chapter 466, but it is limited. I think, Mr. Chair and members, this is a nettlesome problem. I think the amendment fixes the issue when there is insurance. The question is, what do you do when there is no coverage and there is something that goes wrong? And I don't know how to fix that one for you. You know how to fix it when there is coverage and you can access it, and the amendment gets you there. But the policy question is, what do you do when there isn't coverage, when there isn't an ability for someone who's been harmed by negligence of a volunteer to make a recovery?
Mr. Carlson,
that's the issue.
Would it be safe to say that this situation, if the amendment is adopted, you'd have a similar situation the way you have with any other volunteer situation that may arise for anybody, whether they're in the military, not in the military, whether they're your neighbor or somebody you don't know? It would seem to me to be pretty congruent with those situations at this point. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chair, it's reasonably accurate. The reason that this bill is here is because we don't treat volunteers that way across the board. We pass a law to address it, and we have laws that cover many of them: scene of an accident, livestock liability. I mean, they've got the Good Samaritan, volunteer coaches, recreational use of land, breath testing for alcohol tests at the bar. We have a number of areas of law, but it isn't that you're always immune. The legislature has to adopt something that protects that conduct, and that's why this bill is in front of you, because there isn't anything right now that clarifies what the liability for that volunteer would be. That's why Representative Dentmer has the bill in front of you. So,
thank you. Representative Lesh.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I have the same ongoing concerns as Representative Holberg. If insurance did not exist for the soldier's family, if there was no insurance, but adding in the insurance provision, while helpful, I think throws up that additional issue that I brought up as to what's stopping an insurance company from raising your rates just because you're deployed. And Mr. Gehrig brought me 363A.17, that chapter. There's nothing in there which prevents a business from discriminating against a person based on their military service. And I would just feel a lot better if that existed. I can't imagine how upset I would be if I got deployed and then all of a sudden saw my homeowner's rates go up, or if my rates were higher simply because I was in uniform and there was a chance of me getting deployed. So I would just say that, Mr. Chair.
I don't want to do that. Lay it on.
Members, we're going to, and Representative Dentmer, lay this over and try to come back later in the hearing if we can. Otherwise, we'll schedule it the next hearing. At this point, the chair moves to lay this over, and we will. Do I need to take a motion? Do I need to take a vote on that? Oh, yes. We need to adopt the amendment first. We've got an amendment in front of us, members. I think we've worked the amendment over pretty well. Was it? I don't think it was adopted. All in favor of the amendment, the A120711 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. The amendment's adopted. At this point, the chair moves to lay the bill over. All in favor of laying it over, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. We'll lay it over, and we'll come back. Representative Dentmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And committee members, just on a personal note, as probably some of you know, I was mobilized for 20 months after 9/11, and there was no Yellow Ribbon program around at that time for my area in Forest Lake. And if it wasn't for the wrestling team that I coached that I left behind, we heated our house with wood. And several times, team members came out with their parents and hauled wood in for my wife and made sure that our house was kept nice and cozy while I was away for 20 months. I really hope that we can resolve this issue, because this is an issue for a lot of families. Right now we have 3,000 men and women that are deployed from Minnesota, just Minnesota, let alone the active component that is deployed. And we need to do everything we can. These people are in good faith, are volunteering to help people, just like your neighbor would if you had something happen at your place, a tree fall in your house, your neighbors would rally. You know, in the military we have a rally point. And those people would come and help out and support that family. So I already felt, I personally felt that this was something that we could, you know, move on. But thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Detmer, we got mired down a little here. I think we can fix this, and my full intention would be to bring this back, if not today, very soon, at one of our next meetings. So hopefully the issues that were raised, we can work. I think it's just a little language issue. And so, just so you know, and to the Ms. Seeberger, that would be my intention as the chair. So,
yes, and Mr. Chair, and I'm all ears. I'm open to however we can put this together and bring it forward again. I'm here to accommodate that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Dietrich. House File 1833. Representative Druskowski will move House File 1833 and be recommended to pass. And I believe it goes to the floor, to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to our committee, and I understand you have a witness as well, but go ahead. Do you have any amendments, Representative Dietrich?
No, not at this time. Thank you,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead. Tell us a little about this bill and what it does and why we need to pass it.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I promised John, I will be very brief. And so what House File 1833 does is it identifies a perceived a loophole in the eminent domain bill that was passed in 2005. And so, as not to be repetitive, I am going to go ahead and let my constituent and lawyer, Mr. Kirk Schnickner, describe a little bit about the loophole and how it has affected the small businesses and residents that he represents, and what he thinks, how this change will affect those people who are displaced by local units of government in the area of eminent domain. And then, Mr. Chairman, I also have a second testifier, and he is Judge Eric Lipman, and he is going to talk to you a little bit about how often does this happen and what might be the ramifications from the administrative law judge's perspective. So with that, I would turn it over to Mr. Schnickner.
Very good. Mr. Schnickner, welcome to our committee.
Thank you.
You need to identify yourself for our tape record, and upon doing that, you may proceed. Tell us a little about this bill, and go ahead.
All right. Mr. Chairman, my name is Kirk Schnittker, and as Representative Dietrich said, I am a constituent of hers, and I practice as an attorney in the area of eminent domain, and with kind of a specialty of representing businesses and homeowners that are displaced because of government takings. It's a small area of law called relocation law, but the Congress and legislature and state of Minnesota has made the determination that when a person is bought out and their business is bought and they're forced to move, or they're a residential tenant or a residential homeowner, there's certain relocation benefits and assistance that they should be provided. And it's all laid out in state and federal law, and the process generally works pretty well. Generally speaking, the way it works is we run through the process with whatever unit government it might be, and we submit the paperwork and the documentation with the government, and they have a staff person or a consultant that works for them that provides a certain amount of assistance, and claims are made. Sometimes there's disagreements, and it's occasional that there's disagreements as to how much money that ought to be. And when there is, there's an appeal process that's provided. Well, prior to 2006 changes, we had trouble with a lot of that appeal process, and the problems that we had was there was a lot of hearings that were held that weren't really all that fair. We had some times where we'd have a claim against a city where the city council would appoint themselves to be the hearing officer, or they would appoint the city attorney, or they would appoint a city staff person to be the hearing, and it wasn't fair. And we got tired of these systems that were rigged against us, so we proposed a legislation that you get an administrative law judge just the same as you would get if you got displaced by the Minnesota Department of Transportation or another state agency. So it was fair, and you had somebody that was impartial to actually hear the case. And that's worked out. That worked out well. It's a good process, and believe me, your clients actually feel like you have a fair day in court when you actually have a hearing before somebody who you actually think is going to be fair, and it makes a big difference. Well, the problem is that particular statute doesn't address the issue of eligibility. It says when there's a difference in the claim amounts, and I'm not. I don't want to bash all units of government, but some of them do want to take. Things to a little bit too far as you know, kind of rigging the game to their advantage, and they'll do it at times. And some of them at this time have said, okay, since you're not eligible for relocation benefits that we've decided, and you're usually dealing with the staff, we're not going to give you a hearing, and you don't have the right to an ALJ hearing, so an administrative law judge. And so, you know, that's all this is about. It's about just making sure that it's not only on the issue of dollars and cents, but when they determine you're not eligible for it because of some reason, you actually have a hearing in that regard as well. It should straighten it out. Relocation appeals, whether it involves dollar amounts or eligibility, are pretty scarce anyway. My guess is on average they probably only happen once or twice a year in the state of Minnesota. The Department of Transportation, when I deal with them periodically on relocation claims, the folks that are working there can only recall one case that they've ever had in recent history, and that was a case that my office handled probably 5 years ago. They're not very, very common. The costs are pretty minimal. The Office of Administrative Hearings performs these hearings for pretty fair, reasonable costs. I think it's $140 an hour. And most cases are probably handled and they're done within a day. We had a case several years ago that was a long case that took a long time, and I think the cost was approximately $10,000, but it was a big case involving tens of millions of dollars, and the costs are still nominal given the size of some of these projects. But most of them are relatively small cases involving homeowners and small businesses. When we started on this matter, we provided notice to the League of Minnesota Cities and the Department of Transportation, had discussion with them, and had some discussion since then and haven't heard any particular concerns. The issue of cost did come up at one time, and I think that we were able to put that issue to bed. The Department of Transportation, I've talked to the staff people in relocation, the chief relocation person with the Department of Transportation, and he didn't state any particular opposition to this at all, I couldn't speak for him, but I will summarize that he thought it was something that was just a nominal change and probably makes sense since that's what they provide anyway. Other than that, I'd be available to answer any questions if I could.
Thank you, Mr. Schnitker. Representative Dietrich, is there? Oh, we have Judge Lippman.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Eric Lippman. I'm the Assistant Chief Administrative Law Judge for the Minnesota Office of Administrative Hearings. As you well know, OAH never testifies before or against any particular bill, but because I could speak to the cost experience of these cases that OAH has handled and our process for resolving these cases, I did testify about those matters in the Senate, and Representative Dietrich thought it would be helpful if I returned today. So with that, members, I'm glad to answer any questions about our cost experience or these kinds of cases in the process, if that would be helpful.
Thank you. Thank you, Judge Lippman. Any questions from the members? Representative Dietrich, is the other testifier here, Mr. Hines?
Yes.
Mr. Hines, if you wouldn't mind being brief and introducing yourself for the record. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Patrick Hines with the League of Minnesota Cities. The League of Minnesota Cities does not oppose this legislation. We think that it makes sense. Our member cities do have some unease with the effective date, which applies to claims that are pending on or after that date. We do understand that the nature and mechanics of relocation assistant claims are somewhat complicated, so the effective date is similarly complicated. We've expressed our concern with Representative Dietrich and spoken with the bill proponents, and they have said if there's some language that we could mutually agree upon that would help allay our unease, they would be open to doing that. So I just appreciate the opportunity to put our concerns on the record and say we're happy to work with Representative Dietrich going forward to see if we can find perhaps a minor change that would make everyone happy. I'll stand for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. Questions, members? Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, thank you. To the testifier, are you saying that it doesn't have an effective date for the cases going forward, or are you happy with the language that starts at 1.20?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Hines.
Our cities expressed some concern that the effective date applies to pending relocation assistance claims as opposed to claims only made on or after the effective date. Part of the reason for the language is that you have an 18-month period to file a relocation assistance claim. It's in federal law, and it does make drafting the effective date a little different than usual. We understand that, and we're just concerned that it's drafted in the most precise way possible, and we haven't come up with that way yet, but I think we're happy to try to reach an agreement on that.
Representative Mahoney.
So this is a question for Representative Dietrich. Do you have any more committees for this to go through, and do you have an effective date language that's coming forth, or I like the way your bill is, but if you've got changes that you're making, are you planning on that, or
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Dietrich?
Yes. When we originally drafted this bill, it was at least a couple of months ago, and so we've been going with this original draft moving forward. And so I would prefer to keep it the way that it is right now. It has gone through the Senate with this language, and I guess I would prefer to leave it the way that it is. I think it is fair, and I think the testimony that the judge gave, these are very few cases, so I don't think that changing the effective date is going to change the results or the cost of the bill or to the local units of government.
Other questions, members? Hearing none, the chair renews his motion that the bill be recommended to pass and be transferred to the general register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. The bill passes to the general register. Thank you, Representative Dietrich, and testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, House File 2084 is next. Representative Stensrud, please go ahead and introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I have a small amendment, A3, which will put this bill in order for the author. And I would ask if someone could move the bill.
I'll move that, please.
Okay, Representative Scott will move the A3 amendment. Any discussion on the A3 amendment? Seeing none,
Mr. Chair.
Oh, we didn't move the bill yet. the chair will move the bill, House File 2084. And where does it need to go?
Mr. Chair, to the general register would be great.
And the chair will move 2084, be recommended to pass and be transferred to the general register. Representative Scott moves the A3 amendment. Discussion on the amendment, Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. In looking through the details on the amendment A3 on line 1.5, and when we look at the reference point in the actual bill, the word we intended to insert is already in the original bill language, so we could I would hope that we could make an oral amendment to delete line 1.5 on the A3 amendment.
Okay, there's an amendment to the amendment. The chair will move that amendment to the amendment to strike line 1.5 on the amendment. Is that right, Representative Stenzer?
Yes. Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Gehring, could you repeat the amendment to the amendment, please?
Mr. Chair, the proposed amendment is to amend the A3 amendment by deleting line 5.
Any discussion on the amendment to the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. The amendment is amended by deleting line 1.5. Anything else on the amendment, Representative Stenzer? All in favor of the amendment, the A3 amendment as amended, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. The amended amendment is adopted. Representative Stenzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. In previous testimony, they were just discussing being displaced by government takings, and House File 2084 is a bill that does just that, and it helps protect the trash hauling companies in our marketplace across the state. And as a small business owner myself, I found it important to look out for the business owners, in particular in the trash hauling industry across our municipalities and across the state. If a city decides to take over the trash hauling business in its community and really get out of the competitive sort of free market enterprise and go to some sort of a uniform trash hauling, this bill just really allows for fair compensation if the city or municipality decides to displace, take that customer base of business and award that to another competitor. And I would be happy to answer any questions on this bill.
Representative Stenzer, let's move into the testifiers. We've got quite a list of them. Anybody particularly up first? Mr. Tennis first?
Yes, that'd be great.
Okay, can we have Mr. Tennis up, please?
And Mr. Chair, perhaps on deck, we also have a Mike Berkopek.
I've got him second. Thank you, Representative. And Mr. Tennis, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hi, my name is Willie Tennis, Chair, members. We're a small business. My dad and uncle started it in 1966. That's back in the day when the burning barrels were in the backyard, if some of you might remember that, some of you may not. But so that's how long we've been around. And then I started helping my dad and uncle work full-time at the St. Paul Union Stockyards. And about a year into the business, my uncle got transferred. So I was 13, so my dad asked me if I'd be his helper. So I started working when I was 13. And then our business kept growing and growing. And in 78, my brother got involved in the business. And in 88, our parents retired. Since then, our wives are involved. We each have sons and daughters in the business. We have employees that have been with us for 20-plus years. And we've been able to accomplish all the changes over the years, from the burning barrels to the no burning to recycling and all the environmental things that have come up. And we've been able to successfully grow our business. Until recently, the city of Maplewood, we were the biggest hauler there, and we're losing 20% of our business. And with that, this will be the first time in our 46 years that we're going to have to lay employees off. We've never had to have that problem before. Like I say, when in the open market, we've been able to compete and continue to grow our business. This is the first time that we've had a decline in our business. And so with this, all we're looking for is to get compensated for the loss of our business. Like I say, competition in the open market, we're fine with. But when the government steps in, we're kind of helpless. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tennis. Mr. Berkopek, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hello, my name is Mike Berkopek. I'm with Ace Solid Waste, located up in Ramsey, Minnesota. I guess what I'd like to start with, and I'll have a few more comments than Willie, is a reminder, there was significant opposition in Maplewood by the citizens for what happened there. And despite that fact, the Maplewood City Council moved forward and took 20% of Willie's business. It's a huge chunk. I think we all know that businesses have value. Obviously, if they didn't, where would we be from an economic perspective? What would be the incentive for anybody to be in business? I can tell you, for us, building value is what we're all about. And this bill is about recognizing the value of a business and its value to the community. Today we have quite a few haulers in the audience. These are folks who are working hard every day to service customers, and they've come down here today because this issue is very, very important to their business. I can tell you that we could probably pack the house, but those people are out working, and besides that, there was no place to park their truck. I believe that all haulers, especially small locally owned companies, are in favor of this bill. So all haulers, I think, uniformly are in favor of this bill. And please, don't paint us with the utility brush. Since before government even cared about garbage, in my case, our company, 1955, it was started. Haulers have been providing a valuable service to the community. Hauler to customer direct without government interference. Now, times have changed, and reasonable regulation is a good thing for industry. I think you heard Willie talk about that. You know, we've adapted to these changes. We found new and innovative ways to service our customers, and we've made significant investments of time, energy, and money to make the system better. In our minds, we're like your favorite plumber, lawn care company, or other service provider to your home. We are not a utility. Willie gave very good testimony on the impact of government takeover on his family, but there's one more person I just need to mention quickly, and that's Gene from Gene's Disposal. Gene wasn't able to be here today, but he was another one that was kicked out by Maplewood. And throughout this process, Gene's a very small company. I think he maybe has four trucks, maybe five. The process was, his frustration was heart-wrenching. Gene bought the business from his parents. They didn't just give it to him. He bought it. That's what you do in this world. As a matter of fact, he's still paying his mom. His obligation to his mom is for her to enjoy her retirement. And how does he explain this to them, to her, now that payments may have to stop because government took part of his business without compensation? In his mind, and he's told me this, it's stealing. And I have to agree with him. Some of my opposition has thrown it back on you. They have said the state mandates cities and counties to manage waste. I guess I thought about that and I said, okay. But I don't know if you ever thought about, at least in our opinion, the abuse that they would use for this power. In my opinion, it's time for us to pass a law that forces them to take responsibility for the action, and that is the just compensation. Greg and Willie, they were granted a license to haul in Maplewood. They worked real hard, just like a plumber or anybody else. And then 10 years later, the city took it away from them. And they can no longer haul in the city of Maplewood. In the city of Maplewood, seven haulers were displaced. So it isn't just Willie. There were seven haulers. Tennis Sanitation, Jeans Disposal, Highland, Maroney's, Veolia Environmental, and Waste Management. Five local businesses and two national haulers. It's just not fair to throw those businesses to the gutter, businesses that have value. It's not right. The history of government takeover and the fact is interesting, and residents have unilaterally been on our side, and as a matter of fact, it really hasn't happened in a long time. And as a matter of fact, we hoped it would never happen. We fought, people understood, and we won. People understood, and we won. The reason we're here today is because Maplewood has destroyed our hopes and dreams of being successful in this business. We are now in a situation where the uncertainty in our business has increased tenfold. Local haulers use local bankers to finance their businesses. What do we tell them? You know, small business owners give personal guarantees on bank loans. The risk is huge, and the law, as it currently stands, makes repayment uncertain. What would you do? Small family-owned businesses like Ace and others in this room deserve the certainty that if government ever takes their hard-earned business, there will be an opportunity for fair compensation. Obviously, if you're in favor of limited government, you should be in favor of this bill. It does not stop cities from the government takeover of the garbage business, but it does make them recognize the cost the businesses have incurred over many years of risk-taking and hard work to deliver value for their customers, their employees, their families, themselves, and their bankers. If you are part of the opposition and think government-run collection is a better mousetrap, you should be in favor of this bill. You'll hear testimony that organized collection is difficult and hard to implement. There are three basic reasons for this. First, residents have spoken loud and clear in packed city council chambers that the value equation doesn't work for them. Saving a few bucks a month and getting more government and less choice just isn't worth it. Second, there'll be claims of savings on road wear and tear. Based on our analysis of various cities with open collection and government-run collection, there doesn't seem to be a correlation between garbage trucks and road wear and tear. Finally, and this is really the meat of the matter, organized collection is difficult because you're taking someone's business using the police powers of government. Unlike the marketplace, I can't compete against the power of law. We may continue to argue about the citizen desire and the road and wear and tear issue, but this bill resolves the biggest roadblock that makes organized collection difficult, and you should be in favor of it. For us, it's a societal fairness issue. If you believe in government-run garbage collection, you have to believe in just compensation. Regardless, if this bill does not pass, the haulers really have a few questions. Who's going to take responsibility for my truck payments? Who's going to tell my employees they're out of a job through no fault of their own or mine? Who's going to explain to the family of the company owners that those countless hours of work, sleepless nights, and stressful days were all just a waste of time? This is truly the biggest issue that's facing the hauling community, the local hauling community here in this area, and we really hope that you consider it strongly and vote in favor of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other proponents, Representative Stenser?
No, those are my testifiers.
Those are your testifiers. Okay. Mark Sather. Members, we'll take questions at the end if you can jot your questions down for the testifiers.
Mr. Chair, my name is Mark Sather. I'm the city manager of White Bear Lake, and I'm also on the board of directors of, and vice president of the Minnesota Metro Cities. And I'd like to speak to you not only from those capacities, but also someone who's worked for 37 years in three different Minnesota communities, two of which have had organized collection, and one has had a single hauler just through just private market forces. As this bill has worked through the both the House and Senate, I've heard a lot of the testimony, and it seems, I suppose, like most bills, to be evolving. But I have concerns about some of the things I've just heard in terms of the testimony today, in terms of trying to paint cities in the corner of being some sort of an evil empire. Cities are trying to do a good job, trying to do it better, more efficiently, at lower costs. I think all sectors have encouraged us to do that, but most important, our own residents. And it's not that the city is trying to put these small haulers out of business. In fact, I think I can provide some evidence here in my remarks to explain that that isn't necessarily the case. But first off, I'd like to talk about some of the simple advantages of organized collection.
Mr. Sather, just to quickly interject, we've asked both sides to stay within 20 minutes, so I'm just alerting you to that because I know there's several others that want to testify, so you can kind of modify or keep that in mind as you're giving us comments. That leaves about 2 to 3 minutes for each person.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll go very quickly. But first, and it's been submitted that the law requires us to do it. The cities must, under state statutes, provide that all of our residents have organized or have garbage collection. This is one of the most efficient ways I've ever found to do it. Secondly, it protects, organized collection protects our public infrastructure and the investments that we've all made in it. We have, under our system, one truck going down each street a week for collection, one for recycling. Without this, we've heard cases where there's 3 to 5 trucks going through. The wearing out of the infrastructure, I'll remind you, in just a few weeks, the frost is going to be leaving the ground. Our residential streets are not necessarily designed for big, heavy trucks, and garbage trucks, a fully loaded packer, is one of the heaviest that goes down it. We have same-day collection. collection. Let's prefer recycling. That's really important because in White Bear Lake, for instance, we have some of the highest per capita recycling available. And one of the reasons is that we can use a number of advantages that come with organized collection, including incentive pricing and experiments that we've run with yard waste and working with our hauler. We've come up with revenue sharing for our recycling and so forth. We can designate through our contract where our waste is taken. That's really important. We worked with Washington and Ramsey County years ago when they developed a plant to properly process solid waste. Then they started to lose the necessary volume of that because people couldn't designate where their garbage was going. Under the contract, we could. We can protect the interests of our residents so they don't fall into a Superfund-type lawsuit because their waste is contaminating groundwater and so forth, because we can make sure that it's handled properly. We have some of the lowest costs available. And those costs are low because they're lower to the hauler. And the hauler is able to pass that on to our residents. Having one truck rather than several going down, there's efficiencies in terms of fuel, time, and so forth. Employee training. They can take one neighborhood in our city and just say you pick up all the vehicles along the way. We have guaranteed payment for the hauler. We coordinate their billing with our billing. So people get one bill, they pay it. Each month the hauler gets paid for the amount. They don't have to go after other people. There's fuel savings and so forth. I'm sorry, without more time, I can't hit all these things. But let me just explain, too. In my time at White Bear Lake, we've rebid our contract three separate times. Each time, a small East Metro hauler has received that contract. The first time it was Knutson Sanitation, small East Metro, small family-owned business. They were able to beat out some large national contractors. Next time their contract was up for bid, the large nationals came back at it again. They came in with the lowest bid. When that contract actually was later purchased out by a large national contract, when that was up for bid again, a small local St. Paul area hauler, Gopher Sanitation, came in and once again took that contract away. So it isn't necessarily a problem for small haulers. Some aren't going to use it. But the other thing that I'm concerned about, just listening to some of the discussion, is a switch to more or less a sense of entitlement. And I'm concerned from a city standpoint, as we are asked to be more efficient and we look at using the private sector as a partner to this, if we decide to, say, privatize, which we have in several other things, but privatize snow removal, for instance, are we going to have a group of employees coming back saying that government action to do this now has taken this job away from me? Or different groups that represent those people? Or if we have a hauler or a contractor that we're using and another contractor comes by and says, I can do a much better job than that. If we say, we're sorry, we're going to discontinue our service with you hauling snow out of our downtown, we're going to go to another contractor who has a better way of doing it, a more efficient way, are we going to find ourselves eventually in a case where somebody is claiming loss of business as a result of it, either filing a suit or coming for more legislation to protect their interest? So that's my remarks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Berkey. Craig Johnson, and then Joe Harris is on deck.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Johnson, we're trying to follow some time constraints, but welcome. You know the routine, and identify yourself for the record. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Craig Johnson, representing the League of Minnesota Cities. Keep my remarks brief. There are a number of other folks who have very important points they want to make as well. But on behalf of cities statewide, I want to make it clear that we have a very large number of concerns about this legislation. I want to start by pointing out that you're making a change in this bill to takings law in 117, but there is no taking unless the local unit of government is following solid waste law in 115A. And in 115A, we are required to provide solid waste service for all businesses and residences in our community. So the state mandate and the local requirement to do that is what has created a market for people in our communities. The management of how that happens is left to cities and towns. They are given three options. You can do it as a municipal service with municipal employees. You can do it through organized collection, which is planning out how many vendors there will be and what services they will cover and what contracts they will work under. Or you can do it with open collection type systems where there is an enforceable claim against any resident who does not participate. In other words, every house that a waste hauler goes to and asks for business, they know that they have to be getting waste from somebody, guaranteed. That exists right now, and what this legislation does is says that if you use two of those three options, you're exposing your community to takings claims and fairly significant taxpayer burdens because you've made that decision. I would add that when we're talking about this, this isn't a case where they're being told they can't compete. It's they're told that they didn't get the low bid under an organized collection offer. And yes, anytime there's a bid for a product, local government has been told low bid is the most efficient way you can get the best deal for taxpayer money. Now, if we put a service that we're mandated by the state to provide in our community up for low bid, we're being told that that's a potential takings claim for the people who lose the bid. We have an exception in the legislation now that was added as an amendment since it was introduced that says once you have a contract in a community, if you ever lose it to someone else who has a lower bid than you, that's not a takings claim. But the initial time that it's put for public offer by the local unit of government, if you lose the bid, we're saying it's a takings claim. It makes no sense at all. In one case, you could be serving an entire community. You lose the low bid. You lose all of the business in that entire city. In this case, when the city decides to organize, there's a bid. You compete for it. If you win, you get the business. If you don't, you don't. It's the same as every other low bid process government uses for our services. I would add that there are some significant questions of how this actually applies. We have cities that provide municipal service by city employees, also ones that have organized collection that do not serve the entirety of their city yet. City of Shakopee is an example. As they extend city sewer and water, they also extend city garbage service. There are significant portions of the community that are not yet under that, but when city water and sewer goes out, they would also have the garbage service extended. It's provided by municipal employees. This would, in every time that they do that extension now of sewer and water service, if they add garbage service to it, like everywhere else in their community, it's a takings claim under this legislation. And I would add that there are other communities that are growing in outside the metro area. In the metro area, it's easy. We have boundaries, and cities can't really grow beyond them. We're kind of landlocked in many cities. But when you get to the outer rings and then to the growth areas of the state, we have cities that are regularly expanding. And many of them have organized collection or have municipal garbage service collection. And if they now extend that same service in the rest of their new territory under annexation or under service extensions, again, they would be exposed to an inverse condemnation claim. So we have significant concerns about how that plays out. I would add that one thing that this we're not going to have time to get far into probably this year on this issue, but Chapter 117, where this change is being made, is eminent domain changes. It is for determining a negotiated price of real property value and determining through a set of negotiations and then adjudication if it fails what the value of that real property is. If you look at the process that's used for it, real estate appraisers are required to do the valuation on some of this. And the 117 language that was done in 2006 to work on this system really was not set up to deal with things like, is it a taking if your portable garbage truck can't be used in Maplewood anymore but could still be used in every other city that you do service in? Is there a taking there? Is there a taking if you can still go get customers everywhere else? We're not pushing a business out of its office or off of the street it's on in this case. We're doing it through contracts. So I really think, Mr. Chair, that there's a lot of issues that need to be discussed here. I will be happy to be around for questions on this again.
Very good, Mr. Johnson. Thank you. Mr. Harris, then Mr. Freehammer will be next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members
of the committee, identify yourself for the record.
My name is Joe Harris, and I'm a Dakota County Commissioner and a member of the Metro Area Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board. I have had the honor of being a Dakota County Commissioner for 32 years. Solid waste management is an important issue for Dakota County. We are home to the two largest landfills in the state of Minnesota. And it is from this perspective that I am here today to oppose this inverse condemnation bill. You have heard today that this bill is limited in scope and is just a way to protect citizens from government. I strongly disagree. By changing the inverse condemnation law, this bill has widely ranging implications that go far beyond addressing a limited set of grievances. and it is increasing the likelihood that other groups will seek similar special government protection under inverse condemnation laws in the years ahead. You have heard from supporters that this bill that they are disappointed with an organized collection process that recently occurred in one specified incident, the city of Maplewood. Yet increasingly enough, not one sentence in this bill seeks to actually modify that process. Instead of focusing on Chapter 115A that describes organized collection, this bill focuses on Chapter 117 that deals with inverse condemnation. And the result is the creation of a new class of government-protected businesses throughout Minnesota that will have future financial impacts on property taxes for local units of governments across the state. Should inverse condemnation laws even apply to the issue we are discussing? Absolutely not. Under Chapter 115A, local governments are mandated to ensure that all citizens in Minnesota have solid waste services. This means that when you hear arguments that the free market is being taken away when government enacts solid waste policies, it isn't accurate. If solid waste was a free market to begin with, citizens would have the freedom not to have a provider of solid waste services for their homes or businesses. Years ago, the state of Minnesota passed a comprehensive 1980 Solid Waste Act that we have been living with for the last 30-some years. It actually started the year I took office being county commissioner, so I've lived through the whole 1980 Waste Act for the last 30-some years. Let's make sure that everyone, or in that legislation, it makes sure that everyone purchases solid waste services. The notion of a free market has not existed since that law went into effect.
Mr. Harris, just so you can keep in mind your time limits, and we've got some other out-of-town testifiers.
I have about three more sentences, Mr.
Okay,
Chair.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
This proposed legislation does not belong in Chapter 117, which refers to condemnation proceedings. The bottom line is that if we want all solid waste management systems to be successful, counties and cities that are being judged on this performance, your state laws, we need to have the tools available to allow us to continue to perform and meet those standards set down by the state. We cannot afford the threat of having financial payouts or legal proceedings as this proposed legislation will do harm for us. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Harris. Mr. Freehammer, and then Mr. Tripler. Mr. Kanan, if you want to be ready right after Mr. Freehammer.
Good afternoon, Mr.
Welcome to our committee. If you can try to keep your comments directed and to the point, that'd be great.
Yes.
Identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you regarding this bill. My name is Troy Freihammer. I work with Environmental Services Department, Stearns County. I'm also Vice President of the Solid Waste Administrators Association, an affiliate of Association of Minnesota Counties. This bill hinders solid waste administrators in working with their local units of government to fulfill the various statutory responsibilities embodied in the solid waste management laws and rules, including specifically protecting and regulating public health, welfare, and safety by developing environmentally protective waste management systems. For Stearns County, meeting this statutory responsibility is accomplished through the adoption of ordinances effectively making mixed municipal solid waste collection and transportation the sole responsibility of the county. To fulfill this responsibility while maintaining private industry participation in the county licensed and contracted with public and private mixed municipal solid waste haulers to provide this service. Provided the
Provided the firms meet the established license and contract obligations, firms may enter or exit the Stearns County market at any time. However, with this bill, Stearns County faces potentially new liabilities in its contracts with new and existing firms, as well as losing enforcement provisions of its ordinances, license provisions, and contracts. While we as solid waste administrators oppose the concept of inverse condemnation, the language of this particular bill raises many questions. While we appreciate the attempt to narrow the definitions by adding collection, some of the terms used in this legislation have not or do not have legal definitions. Without knowing what mixed municipal solid waste collection is defined as could potentially impact the number of areas that counties contract in, whether it's contract collections, transportation, processing, landfilling, household and small business hazardous waste collection programs, just to name a few. The words direct and indirect also raise questions due to the county's involvement in a number of different activities involving mixed municipal solid waste. Because counties support the backbone of solid waste activities in the state, we have many questions about how the bill may impact facilities and programs in which we have invested in order to carry out our statutory responsibilities. Due to the language placement in Chapter 117, we have additional concerns of how eminent domain may come into play. Tom Cannon, a Volusia County attorney, is here to further address those concerns. On behalf of the solid waste administrators of the state, I request further examination of the unclear definitions as well as eminent domain implications issues occurred before this bill is moved forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fryhammer. Mr. Kanan, and then Mr. Tripler will be after that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for having me here today. My name is Tom Kanan.
Thank you.
I'm an assistant Olmsted County attorney. I'm going to focus, because I don't think any of the others have really, a little bit more on the legal aspects of this. I don't really think it's been thought through completely. One thing that you need to think about, some of the others have touched on it, is, again, the statute 115A.94 deals with how the organized collection process is supposed to work. No one has mentioned subdivision 7 of that statute. That statute says that a political subdivision that organizes collection can engage, and this is a direct quote, in anti-competitive conduct and is immune from liability from antitrust and unfair trade practice claims as a result of organizing collection. I would submit to you that what's proposed here in this legislation is essentially directly contradicted by what's authorized in 115A.94 subdivision 7, because you have basically a claimant here who's saying that the public entity is basically engaged in an unfair restraint of trade by choosing to negotiate with one hauler and not with another. And I think they're inconsistent, and that inconsistency's got to be resolved here. Let's talk a little bit quickly about inverse condemnation law, because we haven't talked much about that. There's an important case which the lawyers present, I'm sure, are aware of. It's called the Penn Central case. It involved the Penn Central Railroad Station in New York City, but all the states have adopted it as the standard to consider when inverse condemnation should apply. In that case, the court considered, and the Minnesota Supreme Court has also adopted these, you have to consider the economic impact of the regulation, the extent to which the regulation interferes with legitimate investment in expectations excuse me, of the property owner, and finally, the character of the regulation. I did some research to see if there had been any cases out there that were analogous to a situation like this, where a waste hauler had basically raised a successful claim arguing that a takings had occurred, and I could not find any. However, I did find one case, Zeman versus City of Minneapolis. It's 552 Northwest 2nd 548, a Supreme Court case from 1996. It's interesting because that was a takings case involving a license. In that case, it involved a landlord in the city of Minneapolis. He owned an apartment building, and he had a license from the city to rent out that apartment building. He lost that license because of repeated criminal activity at his building. He argued in the courts all the way up to the Minnesota Supreme Court that that amounted to a taking of his interest in that license. The Supreme Court applied the Penn Central factors. They said that they noted that there was an economic impact of the loss of his license was substantial because he could not rent out the units without a license. It noted that it did interfere somewhat with his investment-backed expectations because he had rented out the property for many years. However, they went on to note that because the ordinance served an important purpose to protect the public from harm. The revocation of the license in that particular case did not constitute a taking of the owner's property. I think that case is an important case to consider in this situation here as well, because it's one of the few involving the taking allegation of a license. Finally, I just wanted to touch briefly on how is this actually going to work if an inverse condemnation claim is actually raised. As has been alluded to by a couple of the other presenters here, Chapter 117 isn't really set up well for these types of claims. It's set up with the assumption that you're dealing, let's say, with a taking of a strip of land for a public building or an expansion of a right-of-way. What does a public entity have to do if an inverse condemnation case arises out of a situation like this? First of all, it has to identify the property that's being taken. Well, what property here is actually being taken from the property owner? The Zeman case suggests that in some cases, if a license is being taken, that's not a taking of a property interest. So there, we have to struggle, first of all, with what's the property being taken. The second thing Chapter 117 obligates the public entity to do is to complete an appraisal. It has to be completed before the property proposed, before it could be acquired. Well, how can a real estate appraiser put a value on the claimed property interest in this case? There are many variables in a solid waste disposal business, just as there are in any business. Things like cost of salaries fluctuating, cost of gasoline for the trucks, growth or contraction in the size of the community, the effectiveness of marketing versus competitors. Even the condition of the economy can have an effect, because it's been demonstrated, at least locally in Olmsted County, that in good economic times, people create more trash. And if they create more trash, there's more business for the haulers to haul away. All of those factors are going to be very hard for a real estate appraiser to put a firm number on in some kind of an appraisal that's required as part of this inverse condemnation process. The next step is that there has to be a good faith attempt to negotiate to acquire the property interest before eminent domain proceedings can begin. How can we do that if it's going to be so difficult to determine a fair value of the property interest that's allegedly being taken here? The prior bill that was testified about here today actually alludes to the next step, relocation assistance and benefits. Are those going to be paid to an objecting hauler? Statute 117.52 says these benefits need to be paid if the public entities are acquiring real property and the owner has to relocate. It has to provide enough compensation for the owner to purchase a comparable property elsewhere. Are we really going to go down that road in this case? Because that would suggest that the hauler would have to come in and argue, you've taken my business to such an extent that basically I can only be made whole again by moving down the road into another jurisdiction and setting up business elsewhere. Governments, as has already been alluded to, make decisions every day about people that they contract with. It's as wide as public works projects. It's foster care providers. It's even attorneys, frankly, who provide services. I can give you a personal example of my own. I was in private practice before I came to the county attorney's office. In the early 2000s, I was on a court-appointed list to provide court-appointed defense work for people that were facing mental illness commitments and guardianships and conservatorships. I was on that contract with about 12 other people. I lost that contract because the county decided to go with one law firm in the interest of better quality work and at a lower cost. Well, arguably then I should be in this group as well, and I should be able to make a similar claim because I lost out on that business. But I just hitched up my belt and I went out and I looked for other work and I found a way to make it happen. The final thing I wanted to touch on is the attorney's fees award provision. Keep in mind that condemnation law now provides, after the 2006 amendments, that if an award by a court exceeds an offer that's been made by a public entity by more than 40%, an award of attorney's fees to the claimant's attorney is mandatory. That's a scary prospect if you're a public entity, or frankly, if you're a taxpayer that has to pay for that, because, as again I've alluded to earlier, the offers in this case that are going to be based on appraisals with wildly fluctuating information might well be well out of the ballpark of where they should be. What if the public entity's offer comes in at less than 40% of what a court ultimately awards? Then the public entity is going to be faced with having to pay the attorney's fees of the claimant's attorney. That is going to be a great incentive for attorneys to pursue cases in this case And again, the taxpayers ultimately are the ones that are going to be responsible if public entities guess wrong. So for all of those reasons, we'd ask that you reconsider the language in this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kanan. Is there a Mr. Tripler here? Okay. Mr. Tripler, I...
Yes, sir.
We're going to conclude with your testimony. There's another testifier that's from the PCA that can make it back easier. So yep. Can you keep your comments to a couple of minutes, Mr. Tripler, and please identify yourself for the record?
I will track. Okay. My name is Dale Tripler. I'm a private citizen. I live in Maplewood, and for open disclosure, I would like the committee to know that I have served on the Environmental and Natural Resources Committee with the City of Maplewood for the last 4 or 5 years. I also serve on the Planning Commission. I agree with many of the comments that have already been presented in opposition to this piece of legislation, and it just baffles me as to why trash haulers are being treated totally different from anybody else in private industry. It seems ironic that Mr. Tennis would be in here complaining about the loss of 20% of his business when he lost the bid for trash hauling. Last year, he was in competitive bidding for the recycling contract with the City of Maplewood, and he won that bid. So he replaced Eureka. So should he then pay Eureka for their loss of business? No, because this bill only deals with trash hauling. It only deals with waste hauling. It doesn't deal with recycling. And yet there's absolutely no difference between the two. The trucks look the same. The routes are the same. Everything is the same. The only thing that's different is where the end product goes. Second of all, what's happened to free enterprise in this country? All of a sudden now, if you're in a business and your product and your service doesn't match up with your competitors, your prices aren't competitive, you're locked in. You want government to protect you. So if you get bumped out, you're supposed to be paid for being inefficient. I'm at a loss. I don't understand that. The City of Maplewood went through the competitive bidding process like we did with recycling, as it does with maintaining its streets, with all kinds of other things. Everybody had a chance to bid on it. We selected and we told them how we were going to score, and we picked the bid that came in lowest and met all of our criteria. And Tennis and all the other contractors, well, there were only five contractors that actually submitted bids, but they all were competitive, and they all could have won, but we only selected one. And this bill would effectively, in my opinion anyway, this bill would effectively eliminate competitive bidding by cities for other services. In 115A94, the city went through the process that was dictated by state statute. It took us over a year longer than any normal process would have taken us, and it cost us a lot more money to go through the process, and it makes competitiveness going through the process almost impossible. If this is such a good idea, why doesn't it apply to everybody? Why doesn't it apply to every business? I would suggest that if you made this apply to haulers, they'd be screaming bloody murder if you told them that they had to go through 115A94 when they wanted to buy tires or trucks or office supplies. I mean, it would stymie their business. Again, I don't understand why trash haulers are the only ones who are covered by these statutes. And finally, why don't you delete mixed municipal solid waste services and replace it with any services? So it applies to everybody. I just don't understand why waste haulers get a free ride and get to be handled completely differently than everybody else. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tripler. Representative Stensrud, any brief concluding comments for today, and then we'll be laying the bill over.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I guess we've heard lots of testimony, and I just think it'd be important to point out who the customer is. Many of these comments are pointed out as if, in some cases, the city is a customer, and the trash hauling is providing services to a city. And this bill really talks about when the customer is the residents of a city, when it's private citizens. And that really bears some distinction in all of the discussions and all the testimony. So I look forward to, you know, maybe following up with any further questions when we bring the bill back soon.
Very good. At this point, we've run out of committee time, and we have caucuses in session to get to. And so the chair will lay the bill over, and meeting is adjourned.